associate program director at Boulder Giving. I'm not the person you see on your conference program, Jason Franklin, who is our executive director, who unfortunately was stricken with the flu. But with the support of Joel Solomon and Catherine Lorenz and the council staff, we hope to have a fabulous session for you about telling your story. So welcome. Let's just see a show of hands. Who enjoyed the conference? Wow. Okay. Good work, Nellie. Good work, COF. Make sure you fill out your evaluation forms and let them know, the people who work so hard on this, know what you got out of it, because I agree with you. I think it was a great conference. I'm going to first tell you just a little bit about Boulder Giving. Boulder Giving is a New York City-based nonprofit, but our scope is national. And our mission is very simple. We want to inspire people to give more, to risk more, and to be more inspiring with their philanthropy. And we do this through two different techniques. And the first is we tell stories. So we're in the business of storytelling. And we tell stories about exceptional philanthropists who give amazing amounts of money and take huge risks and are incredibly creative and committed. And we tell these stories because we hope that other people will read the stories and think about doing a little bit more, thinking about what difference they can make in their lifetimes with their resources. And then we also try and translate those stories into action. And we do that by coaching people, working with individuals and institutions to help them communicate their story and to help them to persuade their stakeholders to give a little more, to do a little more, and to risk a little more. So that being said, I assume you're all here because you're interested in learning how to tell your story. Is that right? Okay. Well, why is it important to tell a story? I think when you really think about it, almost everything that we think we know are not necessarily things that we've actually experienced. They're stories we've been told. So, you know, if you know how an internal combustion engine works, it's probably not because you actually built one. It's probably because someone told you the story about how it works. Or if you know what the founding core principles of the founding fathers of the United States were, it's not because you sat down and chatted with them or helped them write the Declaration or the Constitution. It's because you've learned those stories. And we also tell stories about ourselves and who we are and why we do what we do. And those stories about our culture, our history, and how the world around us works, and the stories about our own motivations and behavior and character actually are what causes to determine our action. So I like this little anecdote about the Scottish patriot who said, if one could write the ballads of a country, he would not care who makes the laws. Stories in some ways are more powerful determinants than some of the what we think of as the structures that control culture and behavior. And when we change our stories, we change the range of possibilities to us. So I'm going to start by telling you a little story. Have any of you seen, oops, I'm not going to show you that one yet. Have any of you seen the movie Lincoln? Did you notice that Lincoln, according to this, and I didn't know Lincoln, but the story about Lincoln is that he was quite a storyteller. And for those of you who didn't see the movie, there was a little scene where the Northern troops are trying to take over the harbor of Baltimore, and the battle is raging, and they're meeting fierce resistance, and they're waiting to see if the Southern army is going to surrender, and the casualties are mounting, and hanging in the balance are the peace talks and the 13th Amendment and whether or not they're going to be able to get the amendment passed and keep the will of the people and get the Southerners to surrender. And the tension in the room is just awful. Like, you know, the whole outcome of Lincoln, of the war, is hinging on this moment. And Abraham Lincoln chooses that moment to tell a little story about John Adams, and the Americans had sent a gift to England of a portrait of George Washington, and John Adams goes to England to visit with the English government, the first diplomatic trip between the two countries, and he gets a big banquet and he drinks a lot of wine, and so he excuses himself and goes to the lavatory. And hanging over the water closet is the portrait of George Washington. So when he returns to the room, the British are eager to see whether he's been, it's an insult. They want to see whether he understands their opinion of the American, rebels. And he doesn't say anything. And finally they say, well, did you notice the artwork in the water closet? And he said, gentlemen, I'm so pleased with your choice of where to hang our country's gift to you. He said, because there's nothing that will make an Englishman crap faster than the face of General Washington. Now, that's a funny story, right? But for those of you who saw the movie, how did Lincoln use storytelling as a leadership tool? And why do you think he told that story at that moment in time? So anybody who has an idea about that, like, how did he use the story to build his team, to get through a difficult moment, to remind them of their courage, resilience, and power in the face of adversity? Any ideas there? Well, stories are powerful tools, and if you learn to use them wisely, they're also very, very powerful tools for building consensus, leading communities, and moving large groups of people in new directions. So why is it important for foundations to tell our stories? So you might have a personal motivation for making sure that you feel comfortable talking about your foundation. You might want to, you might be excited about what you're doing and want to share it, want to encourage other people to participate, maybe get some additional funding for the projects you're excited about. But what about our collective interest in telling our story? So we as a sector have enjoyed some generous tax benefits for many decades in this country. However, most Americans have very little understanding of how we contribute to the national fabric. What are the historic accomplishments? How would America be different if private foundations didn't exist or if the nonprofit sector weren't as robust as it is? And we're largely invisible. So during a period of fiscal pressure where there are pressures on all of the revenue and spending programs, what will happen if the American people don't understand the value that we contribute? What are our chances of keeping the benefits that we've traditionally enjoyed? And what's our responsibility for making sure that we communicate philanthropy's story, and in particular family philanthropy's story, for those of you who are here, to the American public? And how do we do that? Do we expect the council to do it for us? Do we want one leader to do it? It seems to me that we're kind of a chorus of frogs. And we have our frog pond, and each of us has a different voice. And if you've heard of frog pond, there's like the bullfrog, and there's the little peepers. But all together, those stories add up to create a tapestry. And that tapestry is our collective story. So how many of you have heard some good stories at this conference? And does anybody have an example of a really cool story that you could just quickly sum up that you heard while you were here? Thanks. Yeah.
Thanks.
She's a good storyteller. I was at a session with Philippe Cousteau, and he told a story I didn't know, which was that Jacques Cousteau was in a terrible car crash and broke his back. He wanted to be a pilot. And because of this injury, he was unfit to fly a plane. And his doctor advised him to start swimming in the Mediterranean. And that's how he developed his fascination with the oceans and marine life and became a leader in ecology and thinking about ocean conservation. And that's an interesting story, because what is it about that story? What we think of as misfortune, we transform into opportunity. Now, you have a powerful structure for a story, which is you take the lemon and you turn it into the lemonade. So I thought, what a neat story to be able to tell. Any other great stories?
I went to the movie last night, The Power of Two, about the sisters who had the love cabin. It was an unbelievable story, what they're doing now.
And where did that, how did you respond to that story? Was it emotional? I mean, did that,
it was personal. I have a brother who needs a kidney. That for me was a personal story, and I got to meet the filmmaker, and I got to talk to the sisters, and we shared how, because my family, we have a foundation, because he needs a kidney, I have gotten into kidney research, and we give to UCLA, and I've met the head of the research department there, and it was a personal story that I never knew anything about, nephrology or kidneys, and they were saying how they went to Japan, where there was no type of, transplant program, and they changed that, and it really helped. How you're saying, from lemons, you make lemonade, and how there's such a need for research, and I never knew that, but it hit my family brother.
Thank you. So, one general rule about stories is that stories that hit you up here in your head might be interesting, but stories that hit you in your gut, even before your heart, your gut, that where you have a visceral reaction to that story, or in your heart, those stories tend to make a much deeper imprint and to be much more powerful changers of behavior. So I love the fact that that was a very personal story for you, and that made it very powerful. So we're going to try and help you. We're going to try and give you some tools to feel confident about telling your story. And we really encourage you to take these tools, work on it, and practice. Practice with a real audience. You know, when you walk out of here, or when you go back to your boards, or when you go back to your organizations, actually have a conversation with the rest of your stakeholders about what is our story and how do we tell it, and where are our opportunities to tell it. So the first thing you need to know when you're telling a story is, who am I telling the story to? Because a story is not a set of facts. A story is like a gift. And you wouldn't give a 2-year-old, a necktie. And you wouldn't give a 60-year-old man a toy train. So what is it that you're trying to deliver and to whom in your story? So think of your story as a gift that you're giving. And think about picking that gift so that it really meets the needs of the person who's receiving the gift. And you really design, you pick the pieces that you want to go in your story so that it's going to resonate and it's going to connect with the person who's hearing your story. So some of the people that we might tell our stories to are our own families, as we carry on values and legacies across generations, as we build consensus, as we figure out how to work together as a team, other donors, our peers in philanthropy, community leaders who we're working with in our community, the media, a very different kind of storytelling, and we'll get back to that, or policymakers. So first of all, be clear about who's going to be listening to this story. One size does not fit all. And what is your goal? So we already talked about emotional response and empathy being a very powerful, if you want to tell a powerful story, that's a really good goal to have, but it's not always appropriate. If you're talking to the New York Times, your goal may be quite different. So you might want to encourage personal engagement or action. Please sign my petition. Please join this committee. You might want to be soliciting support or a financial donation. join my board. We'd really want to get you involved. Would you consider making a gift to this organization we're funding? Education or intellectual engagement. I enjoyed that systems thinking session at the beginning of the conference. That was really educational. You know, that was a story that pretty much appealed, but it was a good one, right? I mean, I think I'll remember that. So sometimes your goal is just simply to teach people some new knowledge. Brand building and marketing, we are in that business sometimes, depending on, especially if you're a public charity, you really want to be able to have people associate immediately when they hear your name what you do and what you're all about and how that makes them feel. And so that's sometimes called the elevator speech, and that's about having about a two-sentence story that everyone on your team understands and shares. And wherever you go, you know, Boulder Giving is about inspiring people to give more, risk more, and inspire more. We have our elevator speech. We know what Boulder Giving's brand is, and everyone on our team knows that. And whenever you hear someone from Boulder Giving present, that's going to get reinforced to you. So do you need that? Maybe not. But if you need that, how do you build it? Moving to public policy agenda, conflict resolution, storytelling can be really important. And then just plain old entertainment. So what do you need to think about when you think of your story? And I think we're going to get two great examples coming right up. But one very important thing is a story is not a legal deposition. A story is not a laundry list. A story is a journey. You start in the beginning. You talk about a goal. You talk about challenges that you have to overcome. You have a, what was the word in literature, denouement? You have a turning point in your story, this exciting point where you kind of make it or break it, you know? And then you have the gift that you come home with, the lesson that you learned, the enlightenment, the epiphany. What is it that the story taught us? What is the gift of this journey to all of us that we can take home with us? So a story needs to be built like the Odyssey, right, or the Iliad. I mean, that's the classic structure of a memorable story that provides meaning. And ground your story in details. At that same session with Philippe Cousteau, there was the guy from Bosnia who said, well, we wanted to know where the landmines were, so we asked the kids where the cows exploded. Now, I will not forget that detail. I'm like, okay, I got it. You know, I'm getting the picture here. If he had just said, there was some unexploded ordnance we needed to locate, I would not have remembered that. So the more specific you can be and the more personal you can be, the more people are going to remember your story. So that being said, I'm just going to turn it over to our storytellers. And I'll start with Joel, and they're going to introduce themselves, and they're going to tell you some stories, and they're going to tell you who their audience is, and then we'll talk a little bit about how they constructed that story for their audience. Thanks, Joel.
Thank you. Well, Terry and Zach at least know that I'm a social venture capitalist, and I'm based in Vancouver, Canada. We help through renewal funds to make money for our investors by placing money into organic foods, green products, and environmental innovations. And I'm also proud to serve as an entrepreneur in residence at RSF Social Finance. I have a lot of background in foundations, having managed the spend down of a $20 million private foundation based in Vancouver called the Enswell Foundation. And I've been a board member of Tides in the U.S. I just finished 24 years and have left Tides board now, and helped to build Tides Canada Foundation based in Vancouver and Toronto. And that's my introduction.
I'm Catherine Lorenz, and I'm president of my family's foundation, the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation, based in Texas. My grandparents have 10 children, and I'm one of 23 grandchildren, so it's a large family foundation. Our focus is sustainability in Texas, and in particular, we look at policy, science and policy to impact work in clean energy, water, and natural gas sustainability issues right now. And it might be kind of relevant, the wealth was made in energy and in traditional energy sector in oil and gas, and my grandfather actually is most known for pioneering the technology that now has kind of unleashed this whole shale boom. So the fracking world can both the pro and anti-fracking people point to my grandfather as the reason this has happened. And so I think that's an important piece in the story, because we're also very dedicated, serious environmentalists looking at specifically clean energy solutions in Texas, so and cleaning up the natural gas work in Texas. So it's kind of an interesting tie and part of why the stories are important.
My first story will attempt to take a complex history and turn it into something digestible for you. I was born into money. My father was a major shopping mall developer. I was also born with polycystic kidney disease. And I was told that I might live 2 years or I might live to 80, and there was nothing I could do about it. That was in my early 20s. That sent me seeking and searching to attempt to figure out what were my values and what was my life purpose? What was the meaning of my life, and what was I going to do with the power and privilege that I was born into and the opportunity of the times we're in? My search led me into gardening, French intensive biodynamic gardening, and the natural world and wilderness. And I began to think about natural systems, and that helped to ground me in looking at the state of the world and society and how things appeared to me to be going. So the reality of progressive kidney disease and kidney failure led me to consider the idea that as my blood got more toxic, that what I really wanted and longed for was cleaner blood. Well, being the child of a shopping mall industry and looking at what I believed had happened with the economic system, all of its wonders, perhaps human ingenuity outracing human wisdom is a way that I thought about it. We've been able to create more ways to exploit than we have to figure out how to look after the future. So the pursuit of cleaner money became my life work. I joined a business partner, Carol Newell, to deploy roughly $60 million, in a regional sustainable economy model in British Columbia using integrated uses of capital for social goods. For-profit, not-for-profit, inner skills and leadership development and capacity for the things we cared about, and public policy influence and politics. I want to inspire you to reflect on your deepest values and life purpose. And I want to be helpful in any way possible, hopefully by telling my story, to inspire you to dedicate your life and your work and your power and privilege towards being sure that future generations have at least the important parts of what we experience today.
All right. So my story is slightly different in that I'm not speaking to you, but to younger cousins in my family. You really would have loved and admired your grandparents. Your grandfather was humble, hardworking, and a very, very stubborn man. He stood for what he believed in, and he did things on his own, even when the whole world told him he was crazy. We called him Poopa. His parents were Greek immigrants, and the Greek word for grandfather is papu. But your cousin Megan, the oldest cousin, said it backwards at first, and it just stuck. So when your grandfather was just about your age, his mother died. He was left to take care of his siblings and did odd jobs so he could bring home food home to the family And he often talked about going fishing after school so he could bring home a few fish so that his siblings could eat. His mom's dying wish was that her kids would be educated because neither she nor her husband were literate in English or in Greek. So, of course, Poopaw worked hard to make sure his mother's wish came true. He worked his way through college at Texas A&M, and he even had to borrow money from his dad's gambling buddies a few times in order to stay in school. His passion was astronomy, but he wanted to make more money than an astronomer would be able to make when he graduated. So instead, he double majored in geology and petroleum engineering. He heard that that was where you could make the most money, and he graduated first in his class. So after working for several companies, he went on to start his own oil and gas company with his brother, Johnny. As the company became more and more successful, Poopaw never forgot his roots as a poor son of immigrant parents. He was always generous to people who had a similar story to his own childhood. In the late 60s, he developed a new passion, sustainability. He always said, if you can't make the world work with 6 billion people, how are you going to make it work with 10 billion people? He knew that humans were on track to destroy the world's finite resources, and he wanted to do something about it. In the 70s, he brought together annually CEOs from the world's top companies to discuss how the private sector could approach their businesses with sustainability in mind. They all thought he was insane. He went on to endow several institutions to focus on sustainability work. He even founded a whole city to live in harmony with nature, and it now has 100,000 people living there. Your grandmother was an amazing woman as well. We called her Gaga, also from Megan. Messed that grandma thing up. They were such a great pair. To start with, she had 10 children. Can you even imagine how crazy and hectic life was with 10 children? She was very involved in volunteering in the community and giving back wherever she could. Each Christmas, she would load up her car with all of her kids and gifts and head to the local children's hospitals. All the kids would take the gifts around to the different wards and help celebrate Christmas with the kids who had to spend Christmas in the hospital. She was always so giving like that, inviting people into her home and giving in whatever way she could. Really, both of our grandparents were so giving. I guess that's why they joined the Giving Pledge. They'd always intended to give away the majority of their wealth. They felt they had been so lucky in life, and they wanted their resources to go to improving the world for those who weren't quite so lucky. And now we are lucky enough to get to be a part of their foundation. Since Gaga and Poopaw had 10 kids and 23 grandkids, there are a lot of us working together. But it can be really fun to carry out the wishes of our grandparents together as a family. I hope you feel as inspired as I do to carry on their legacy with this foundation.
So now what we'd like is to hear from you about what in those stories worked for you, didn't work for you. Don't be afraid. These guys are tough, so they can take it. What did you hear as themes? What did you learn about storytelling that you might use in your own story? So just reflections back from listening to those two stories. Anyone want to step up?
We won't listen.
Thank you.
I was struck in Catherine's story that your grandfather kind of made a 180 in between the work that he'd done and his philanthropy. And maybe it's a separate story, but I think there's a really important message about learning and not being afraid to admit mistakes and move on in a better way. Or I think there's something there that's a really rich kernel.
Yeah, I really want to know about how that transition happened. What the enlightenment
right.
moment or what happened? I'm
Donatella Meadows. Yeah, he got into systems thinking. So, what about some details? Were there details in those stories that made the stories richer? What did you hear that was like a memorable detail from the story, Terry?
Well, I had two details from Joel's story that grabbed me: the blood. Mm-hmm. Clean blood,
yeah,
clean money.
Yeah.
Blood hunts are, you know, it's an issue in my family because we have adopted kids that are not blood. And what does that mean? because of a trust documents that were written long, long ago.
Yeah.
Problem. And the other was human ingenuity outweighing human wisdom. That's going to stick.
Okay.
You know, there's little pieces of the story that I can hang my own stories off of.
So that's a metaphor. So the clean blood, clean money is a way of saying what's going on inside of me, which is that I can't process waste as fast as I'm producing it, is also going on in the world. And if I care about, I can take what I've learned personally and use that as a metaphor to engage in the world. So that's, so I'm just kind of picking apart what are the narrative devices. Like, you probably didn't hear narrative devices. You heard a story, but there are narrative devices. The story of George Mitchell starting out as an oil and gas developer and then turning in to a man who was passionate about sustainability is a narrative arc, right? Like, I started out in this direction. I had a turning point where I decided I wanted to use my resources to solve the problem of clean energy, not to create the problem of dirty energy. So that's a turning point. Anything else you heard in the stories? Yeah.
I love the details that Catherine used to bring to life her grandfather's poverty, about the fact that his parents were illiterate and both speak in English, and the story of him getting fish for his siblings was, you know, instead of just saying he grew up poor, he was an immigrant. Those details make it much more tangible.
Yeah, I see a lot of heads nodding there. I don't know about you, but when she started out saying you would have really loved your grandfather, I was like, because I really loved my grandfather, and he started to, I was immediately like, yes, the family, I was immediately emotionally connected right at that entrance point. So now what we're going to do is we're going to ask Joel and Catherine to tell a different story for a different audience, and we're going to look at and compare and reflect on how they take the same material, which is kind of their life and their relationship with their work and their family foundation, and choose a very different structure to communicate to a different audience. So are you okay going first? Thanks, you guys. You've been really good sports.
So about 5 years ago, my close friend gave me her kidney, and everything went really well. Now I'm 58, and I've spent a career working to create conditions for change and thinking about how to affect the future. And I came to the idea early on that investing in capacity and infrastructure and leadership over a period of time and attempting to leave some kind of an organization or institution that could amplify and take our work much further would actually be a more lasting contribution. And we actually came on the idea of stories that our work, that even $50 million or $1 billion is really tiny drop in the bucket of the scale of global issues. And so that stories were actually what we wanted to do. And the size of our number of zeros was not as important as the stories that were within them. And we noticed that all of us in this room were, I think all of us, we're living through the thing called the millennium, you know, which you only get to do every 1,000 years. And so that's an interesting historic time. We were talking about peak oil and peak all kinds of things, species extinction and this sort of thing. So how could we invest ourselves into stories about people who actually did their best and tried? And how could this generation that's alive right now, boomers today, for example, we're probably the luckiest generation ever, because everything we have the world at our fingertips, and we have the luxury of just about anything we want. We're also at risk of being the biggest losers ever, because we just sit on it, and now we're going to retire and play golf or ski or whatever it is we do potentially. Yet future generations are going to look back and ask us, what the heck were you guys doing?
What were you thinking?
What were you thinking? So Our infrastructure. I mentioned the four areas, and so we came out of our investing side with a business now that called Renewal that creates funds. And if our next fund works, we will have placed over $100 million as a mission investment entity, doing early stage growth capital to make money for our investors. Secondly, on the foundation side, I mentioned that Inswell spent down its $20 million, and our biggest grantee, and we spent about $5 million investing in Tides Canada, which now on an annual basis supports individuals, families, and institutions who give away and do transactions of $25 million or more, and is growing steadily and having an impact on changing the face of philanthropy in Canada. Third is, we got involved with an institution that actually I had, where the kidney came from. The kidney, my life purpose, and my wife, all I found through an educational retreat center called Hollyhock on Cortez Island. And we realized that there was a campus that had been invested in human capacity, inner skills, psychological, emotional, and spiritual, but also cared about social change and supporting leaders. And so we also put about $5 million into the possibility that an institution like this of lifelong learning might continue into the future when it will be even more needed. Fourth, one of our early investees who became my best friend decided he was very frustrated being an organic smoothie entrepreneur with a company called Happy Planet. And though that was going quite well, he got frustrated and decided to go into politics. And he didn't really like the left-right paradigm so much, and none of us did. And we ended up being part of launching a new political party in Vancouver called Vision Vancouver, which has now, in a coalition of center and progressive and green voters, swept most of the offices and control of city council, et cetera, in Vancouver on a very progressive, greenest city in the world, creative economy, solve homelessness, affordable housing kind of an agenda. And the combination of these institutions, I'm now somewhat of a freelancer. Carol had an idea to invest the money and then be done with the major part of it, leaving behind these infrastructures and stories. And we've attracted a lot of attention from the federal government and the oil and gas industry in Alberta, who want to build pipelines across BC to deliver tar sands to China and things like that. And so, us just innocently starting out to try to create conditions for good things to happen have ended up creating something that is agitating in a good way, national conversation in Canada that I hope will lead to something. And my message to you is think about capacity, leaders, and infrastructure, because of what one person given the right tools, what one organization set up properly, the impact can go on for and ripple for a long, long time.
Wow. I think it's just rubbing against your shirt there. That's not correct.
Great story.
Thank you.
So do you want to do your second story?
Sure. So in my second story, I'm now in a very different role, speaking as the head of our foundation to a room of Texas policymakers.
Put on your 10-gallon hat.
Texas has a critical decision to make. Will we continue to be the nation's leader in energy, or are we going to let other states surpass us? As you know, Texas is home to the nation's energy center. We lead the nation in total electricity consumption also. On a per capita basis, Texans consume significantly more electricity than most Americans. To make matters worse, Texas emits more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere than any other state in the U.S. In fact, if Texas were a country, just the state of Texas would be the seventh highest carbon dioxide polluter in the world. If we were a country, we would be number seven in carbon dioxide pollution. But we have a tremendous opportunity. We can benefit from a new green economy based on clean energy sources and energy efficiency. We have abundant sun and wind. We are ideal for clean energy generation. We have a vibrant technology industry and impressive potential for increasing energy efficiency. Texas can dramatically cut our greenhouse gases and still meet the projected growth in demand for electricity. Even better, by doing this, we can add new jobs and conserve the scarce water resources required for coal plants to function. Remember how bad that drought was in 2011? We do not have enough water to keep our coal plants running. Our foundation, funded by oil and gas money, commissioned a report that showed that half of the predicted increase in demand for electricity can be met using energy efficiency. These include more energy efficient buildings and incentive programs and would also provide tens of thousands of jobs. And even if you don't think greenhouse gases are a problem, which I know many of you don't, cleaning up dirty coal plants should still be a key priority. They emit horrible pollutants like mercury, nitrogen oxide, sulfur dioxide, particulate matter. They are awful for health of the children of these cities. So let's shut down these coal plants and use our resources more efficiently. Now is the time to harness our state's expertise and emerge as the nation's leading clean energy economy. They don't listen to me.
So once again, I would welcome your reflections about what worked in each of these stories, what connected with you, and kind of observations about how the story was crafted to a particular response from a particular audience. So, yeah.
I was really struck in Catherine's story that she was able to say we to her audience.
That's interesting.
I think who the messenger is often matters, and this foundation, because of its roots, is in an extraordinary position to deliver a message and is able to say we.
Any other observations?
Catherine laid out the facts, and then she identified the solution, and at the end she made a call to action, all-inclusive and non-threatening.
Right. So the two stories were very different. This was a story about inspiration. This was a story about making a deal. This was an argument to say, you know what? Look at the logic here, and I think your best interest is to invest in this program. So she was making a case, right? She wasn't trying to emotionally move the Texas state legislature. She was saying, get smart, because if you want to stay in the lead, you might want to think about clean energy, right?
And also create jobs. That was very powerful.
Right. So it's in your interest politically to follow this path. Any other observations about how these two stories differed or? Well, most good orators use storytelling devices. So you notice that Catherine used repetition there. So when she said, if Texas were a country, we'd be the seventh largest carbon emitter. And then she said that again, because she was like, I really want this to sink into you. If you look at great orators, they will use a narrative flow. A speech doesn't have to be a story. A speech can be, you know, welcome to Miami. We hope you enjoy our aquarium. And the ladies' rooms are down the hall, and lunch will be served at 12. I mean, that can be a speech, but it's not a story. But it's probably not a speech you're going to remember. So, I mean, I think the difference is the purpose and the audience. And then, again, if you want to be a powerful speaker, you might want to figure out how to enliven your speech with a narrative structure. Make it personal, make it detailed, give it either an inspirational framework, a deal-making framework, an emotionally moving framework, a personal framework. Any one of those can work.
So I was a completely terrified public speaker for most of my life. And I knew that the work I was doing, this was going to be a problem. So I went to first a workshop, 3-day training with a storytelling coach, a woman named Gail Larson. If any of you run into her, she does an excellent job of helping ground you in kind of your core story to work from. And then a number of years later, last fall, after I had been doing a lot of speaking, I got invited to do a TEDx talk in Vancouver, and it's a really big one. They're pretty serious about it. And for example, they sold out 2,300 seats, and maybe it was the largest TEDx ever done. They sold them out in a week. So that was a huge big deal for me. And they also provided coaching and training. That was the lure. And so I had to write drafts and drafts and drafts, and they kept throwing them out and just tearing it apart and this kind of thing. And it turned out to be a wonderful experience for me. And so I'm testifying to this is an art and a science, and there's training, and you will get better. And I think Sarah said in the beginning about practicing, but it is a practice, and it's a lifelong practice. And what finally got me to do it was it's all practice. It's all practice, and maybe someday I'll think I got there. And so that relaxed me into it, and I just encourage all of you to tell stories. I guess I told a third story.
Good. We've got a lot of good stories. And so now what we're going to ask you all to do is at your tables, we want you each to take a little time to reflect and then share with your table a two-sentence elevator speech about your foundation. So think of two sentences. You're in an elevator. You're at the Council Family Philanthropy Conference. Someone says, "Hi, what do you do?" And you're going to answer with two sentences. And then share that with your table. I'll give you a little cue. We'll give you 2 minutes to think about it. And each one of you share that with your table and give yourselves a little feedback, like, did you get it? Did it make sense? Did you want to know more? Did you want my card? You want to work together? So why don't you take some time to do that, and then think about whether that's something that you want to go back and work on. Like, would everybody in your foundation have the same message? Would that be helpful? So turn around and give yourselves, I'll give you little time if you want to think, or even if you want to write something down, that's okay, if you're the kind of person who wants to write it down. Good job, you guys. Okay, you guys, I'm so sorry that you had nothing interesting to say to each other, and you're all so shy. Now, I think this is a great sign of a great conference, which is that there's a lot of relaxed and open interaction. I'm so happy to see that, and I give credit to the conference planners to have left you all in such a convivial mood. So we're going to take a few minutes to get some feedback. If anyone wants to stand up and talk about, like, what did you learn? Do you want to share your elevator story? Do you have some takeaways? Do you have some plans about how you might work, how you might take what you've learned today and go back to your foundation and take steps to cultivate a storytelling culture or for yourself personally? So any feedback from your table discussions? Go, Terry.
Well, it's not for my table discussion, but it was about being comfortable public speaking. And one of the things that I learned, and this was so helpful to me, I learned it 20 years ago, and someone said to me, remember that every single person in your audience wants to have had a good time. that they are not the enemy. Maybe there's one or two people that really, are just waiting for me to fall on my face. But most everybody doesn't want to be wasting their time, and they want to have had a good experience. So they are on your side. They are going to help you make eye contact with them and have a relationship with them. And think about what they want to hear, that whole notion of thinking about your audience. And I'll tell you, totally transformed my public speaking from, oh my God, to, okay, here we go. This is really an opportunity. We're all going to have a good time together. It changed everything for me. So I wanted to share.
Thanks, Terry. Yeah? Oh, okay. And I think the council would like us to speak into the mic so they can record the session. So I'm sorry I forgot to remind you of that. Anybody else? I mean, you guys were so busy talking to each other. I'm curious. What did you learn?
Well, this is I was thinking about...
Oh, wait. Mic. Let's do the mic, and then you can come up next. Thanks.
I need a little help on this. Who was the first James Bond?
Sean Connery.
There you go. Okay. It was a mental moment there. Sean, and it came from something that Joel was talking about.
I heard a story, of course. I heard a story about Sean Connery. When he took on that role, he was extremely uncomfortable with playing James Bond. He was a Welshman, and he had just kind of gotten identified for it. And so what the director said to him is, we're having this James Bond suit made for you, and we want you to wear it all the time. You don't have to wear it in the shower, but we want you to go home for a week, and we want you to wear it day, night, sleeping, everything except the shower. And at the end of the week, you will have assumed the James Bond persona. And indeed he did, and his first movie, he came out as the James Bond. And why I tell this story is because of what Joel was talking about, and there was something that, maybe it was about the storytelling coach that you used or something else, but it's almost as if you have to get that story into your DNA, and when you do that, you have no fear because you're so passionate and it's coming from your heart. And when you do that, then it resonates with, again, 98% of the people, except the two frenemies that are, you know, hanging around. So that was, I just wanted to share that.
Thank you.
I think what we kept coming back to was the fact that there's no one-size-fits-all way to tell this story. We came up with the example of, like, in the elevator here at the conference, you can just launch right into it because we're all in the same world and we have the same lingo. But in another building, maybe the person doesn't even know what philanthropy is or thinks that foundation is something from construction. So I think that ties in really well with step number one in telling the story, which is know your audience and know who you're trying to talk to. And I believe that involves listening, and listening is a big component of storytelling to me.
Thank you. Can you introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm Chris Rick. I'm from the Russell Family Foundation in Tacoma, Washington.
Thanks, Chris. Anybody else? Okay. So that just reminds me of one of my favorite stories, which is Dumbo, the elephant, which I had a two-year-old who watched it like twice a day for 3 months. So I learned it very closely. But in that story, Dumbo has a magic tail feather. And when he has the magic tail feather, he can fly. And one day he loses the magic tail feather. Now, the magic tail feather is just his confidence, right? And he loses the magic tail feather. And his friends are saying, Dumbo, Dumbo, it was just a story. You really can fly. which also reminds me of when I was about three, my mother threw me into the swimming pool with the little arm bubbles, and I swam and swam and swam. And one day she forgot to put them on, and she threw me into the pool, and I swam and swam and swam. And she looked down, and she said, oh, my God, you don't have your arm bubbles on, at which point I sank like a stone. and she had to jump in with all her clothes on and pull me out. So that idea of believing your own story about your power to do what needs to be done. So when we get to this question about believing your own story, I think that stories are kind of like hermit shell crabs. And so you're right. We get them into our DNA, and we tell our story, and we begin to become our story, and we believe our own story. But there's a point at which what can happen? Have you ever known someone who tells the same story over and over again? what can happen when you're telling the same story you told 10 years ago? What's your relationship with that story? It's kind of like the hermit shell crab that's too small for the crab. And sometimes as we have these stories that we give to the outside world and we develop them, we become very invested in them. And it's hard for us to say, gosh, I don't know if this story is really true anymore. You know, I have a story about a very successful family foundation that integrated the younger generation 20 years ago, but are we integrating the younger generation today? Is that still really true? Or are we kind of resting on our story and not challenging ourselves to do the work that we need to do now, which may be different than what we were successful in doing in the past? So while we're here telling you to get your act together and get your story together, I also want to say, be careful that you don't get trapped in your story. And every once in a while, go back and look at your myths and your stories and your legends and say, is it time for a new chapter? Are we called to change this story and add something new to it? And what is it about our history that we really want to carry into the future? And what are we ready to let go of and change and experiment and take new risks around? So that being said, Joel and Catherine are going to just jump in here a little bit about vulnerability and control in storytelling.
Sure, yeah. So, I mean, part of why I set up here and why I do these sorts of things and sit on panels is because when I first started in, you know, getting involved in philanthropy about 10 years ago, I was so moved and inspired by certain people who would share their stories and be vulnerable. And it took a long time for me to be able to actually even talk about it openly with friends and family, much less with the public, about, you know, that we had a family foundation and that there was all this wealth and all those issues that come with it, which I'm sure many of you have had and struggled with. But I think for me, it's actually been very empowering to be able to kind of gain the confidence to be able to talk about it openly. But I do that because I was so inspired by others, and I'm sure they don't even know how much they inspired me. And my hope in doing that is that I might, you know, help other people in their journey to being more open and being able to be more confident talking about the work. And the real thing is about the work. I mean, the more you share about your work, the more you share about the reason you're passionate about it and the reason you do it and the things and the people that inspired you to do it and what you're trying to achieve, in my opinion, the more you might inspire others to join you in your work or to have the same sort of interests and passions. And so I would really just encourage you to tell your story more than you think you might otherwise do in an effort to, you know, enhance the impact that you're having in the world.
Thanks. And as most of us, I'm sure, are aware, we came from storytelling backgrounds where everything was transmitted, or lots was transmitted through stories. And I think it's crucial that we carry that on. Sarah suggested talking about the idea of dealing with media, which is a certain kind of an audience. There's a two poles of desire. One is to be provocative and actually say something interesting and that might stir people some. And then the other side is to be super cautious, not reveal, afraid of the unknown and afraid of some legitimate things that can happen. And talking about money in particular, it's been a long journey for me to figure out exactly how. And you talk about in the elevator, what exactly do you say and who are you talking to? So then when you get to the level of what I shared a bit of before, where what you do that you think is apple pie and the nicest thing that could happen becomes controversial with someone else. And I think if each of us were to consider it, there is actually a version of telling the truth about where we come from and what we think about that will be controversial to a whole lot of people. So we tend to draw back in and then be too cautious, don't share anything, maybe not even speak, not even talk. So now I've ended up, I had years and years of just positive media experiences and profiles and journalists that would listen for a long time get intrigued. And then because of the intersection of all the activities I was involved in, especially stepping into politics, created a different kind of attention, which were from people who were clearly opposed for whatever reasons, maybe political, and who scour tape recordings of things like this, looking for some little phrase or sentence to try to be damaging with. So I don't really have the answer about it, except to say that as one does tell the story, those things have to be weighed, and it's good to have, at some point, outside professional advice to listen and coach and think about how to have both a very powerful story but thread the right needles.
Yeah. So one way of thinking about that is, are you in a safe place to share your story? How open do you want to be? If you can speak from the heart, that's much more powerful, we know. But not all places are safe to speak from your heart. Another place to think about is on the web and in social media. What are you sharing? Will it come back to haunt you? We all teach our children to be conscious of the trail of breadcrumbs they're leaving with all of their internet activity, and we also need to think about that. So we live in a very different world where our stories become public in a variety of different ways, and you probably do want to be in control of that. I'm sure a lot of people have had experiences where that got a little out of control, or something that they didn't intend got blown up or focused on in ways that made them uncomfortable. So
the thought I want to leave you with, though, is that it's easy to, somebody criticizes you or something gets said, and then you assume that that's a huge, loud voice. And I've also been through that experience where nobody's really listening that much to clearly angry, critical, condemning voices. And so this is, you know, I want to leave you with, take a little more risk, test it out, because it's important that we share stories about things that matter.
So finally, speaking of things that matter, I want us all, as we close, to be thinking about what are the stories that we will tell our great-great-grandchildren about the work that we did with our resources, our time, talent, and treasure, to address the problems that we know we're facing today that will impact future generations. And this is a poem, some of you may be familiar with it, by a man named Drew Dellinger. And he says, "What did you do once you knew? It's 3:23 in the morning and I'm awake because my great-great-grandchildren won't let me sleep. My great-great-grandchildren ask me in dreams, what did you do while the planet was plundered? What did you do when the earth was unraveling? Surely you did something. When the sensors started failing, surely you did something as the mammals, reptiles, and birds were dying. Surely you did something. Did you fill the streets with protest when democracy was stolen? What did you do once you knew?" So I think we're all have a responsibility to create a story in which we can tell our great-grandchildren what we did to make sure that they have a planet and a civilization that supports their human dignity. So thank you so much for coming, and thank you for all you do.